This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Hey, it's International Compost Awareness Week. But here in Vermont, officials are hoping that every week will be Compost Awareness Week. Compost is becoming mandatory in Vermont as part of a phased-in plan for recycling. The first changes go into effect this summer, so we're going to spend a little time today looking at the regulations and how they're likely to affect you or your business. And we're going to get tips on exactly how to compost, whether you live in a tiny apartment or a country house with a big backyard garden. Joining me now is Josh Kelly, an environmental analyst with the Waste Management and Prevention Division at the Agency of Natural Resources. He's an expert in Vermont's universal recycling law. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
That's quite a thing, huh, to be an expert in Vermont's universal recycling law.
I haven't heard it yet. That's great.
So maybe first you can tell us a little bit about the goal of the law, because it is called the universal recycling law, but it also includes composting.
Yeah, that's correct. The goal of the universal recycling law is to really increase Vermont's diversion rate. To capture and divert valuable materials such as recyclables, and we use the term organics, but that basically means food scraps, leaf and yard debris, things like that, things that can be put to beneficial uses. Vermont's recycling rate has stagnated for the past decade between 30 and 36%. So this law is set to change that.
But this law is going to take 6 years to be phased in completely. Why have such a long lead time?
Great question. Really, that's for the infrastructure and the collection programs to develop, to give time for those things to come to fruition.
So get us through the beginning here, because the first parts of the law are actually going to go into effect this summer.
Correct. So this summer there are two deadlines, July 1, 2014. And the first is for transfer stations to basically accept recyclables. If they're not already, they need to accept those recyclables. And there's actually a list of the specific ones. And then for generators of food waste, those that produce 104 tons per year, which is about 2 tons per week or more, and if they're within 20 miles of a certified facility that's able to accept it, they need to separate that material.
All right, let's take those two parts separately. But first, let me invite callers into this conversation, because I know a lot of people have questions about this universal recycling law. And if you do, you can ask them by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Or third choice here, you can go to our Facebook page. We're getting people who are posting pictures of their compost pile or compost bin. We'd love to see yours. Maybe you're a renter and you store your compost in the freezer. You can take a picture of that too. Again, go to Facebook and you can find Vermont Edition to share a photo there. But Josh Kelly with Agency of Natural Resources is here with us, and he's helping to explain the law as we talk first about what's going to be required and then look at how we do it. So two different things here. One is that transfer stations are going to have to accept recyclables starting in July of 2014. Mm-hmm. Don't most already do that?
Yeah, that's correct. Most do. But if they don't, they have to begin doing that. And this is part of the law's structure to provide the place, the convenience for people to divert material. So in essence, you know, if recyclables eventually next summer is when recyclables are being banned from landfill disposal. And so in order to get ahead of that, we're having transfer stations and other places where you can dispose of trash need to collect recyclables at those locations and at no additional cost.
Right. That's a key part there. They're not allowed to charge you to take your recyclables there.
Correct. Correct.
Are they allowed to bump up the price of the trash that they're collecting?
Yes. Yes.
So, okay, so there's that piece of things. And then there's also, you mentioned that for very large companies, corporations, institutions, there is a mandatory composting component going into effect this summer.
Yeah, and I guess I would just describe it as a mandatory, you know, separation and diversion. Part of the universal recycling law was to put in place a food recovery hierarchy, which really in many ways mirrors what the EPA has had for years. It's really a prioritized list of what to do with organic material.
And food recovery,
yeah.
Hierarchy sounds, you know, so official, but really it's just saying try to not create so much food waste in the first place.
Exactly.
Secondarily, try to eat it. You know, eat your leftovers. Yep. Thirdly, find some other way to use it, like animal food scraps. And then fourthly, compost it, right? Is that sort of the hierarchy
yes.
kind of thing we're talking about here?
Yeah, exactly. So so there are, you know, if you're a supermarket, say, you should think about what food or other quality food materials that you have that you could donate for people to consume through the Vermont Food Bank or other food shelves. And then as you work down that list, right, animal feed is next. And then composting is, and anaerobic digestion are on the list as well.
So for the institutions that produce, what is it, more than 104 metric tons?
104 tons.
Tons of food waste per year. Who are we talking about? Who does that?
So we've used the example of Fletcher Allen and the University of Vermont many times, both of which are already diverting the lion's share of their food waste to composting right now. So it would be other colleges and universities, a few hospitals, in some cases food manufacturing businesses that produce a lot of waste, but many of them are already doing something with that material. It's often not as cost-effective for them just to throw it away. There's other beneficial uses they can do with that. So those are your big generators, so to speak. Those are a few of them that are out there. Next year, in July 1, 2015, when we're looking at those that produce 52 tons per year, which is about one ton a week, that's going to be your large supermarkets and some smaller colleges and universities, other types of institutions, maybe a mid-sized hospital or something like that.
Okay. And then the other part of that is they're only required to do that if they are within 20 miles of a place where they can send their food to. So
right.
Like what are we talking about? Digesters, anaerobic digesters, that kind of place?
Eventually digesters, yeah. There isn't a digester that is taking sort of post-consumer food scraps right now at on a large scale. But yeah, digesters would be part of that solution too. The Agency of Natural Resources does certify these facilities, composters and digesters that manage and accept food materials. Mostly the bulk of the food scraps that are being separated and diverted right now is to composting, but there is the intent and many digesters to open up more streams such as food scraps. There a lot of food processing residuals, so more of that manufacturing waste, the whey, such as from Ben and Jerry's ice cream, that kind of thing, is going to digesters. But the sort of run-of-the-mill plate scrapings kind of stuff is right now mainly going to composters.
And are most of the people or the organizations that are going to be affected by this law starting this year, are most of them within 20 miles of someplace that they can drop off these food scraps?
That's a great question. We have just started to look at our list of two-ton generators or who we think are in that range and to figure out who's within 20 miles. So actually, several months ago, we sent a letter to 770 food scrap generators. And that letter was to those that produce around one ton or more. Or
I was
going to
say, I didn't get that letter.
Yeah, you didn't get the letter. So that letter went out, making people aware of the law, making them aware that they may produce this amount. But we didn't have the best data on everybody. So some people got the letter that really won't need to comply for a while. But we were trying to – we had the best data we had, so we had to sort of send it out. So now we're sort of working on the two-ton generators that will need to comply by July 1 and to sort of re-notify them in partnership with solid waste districts that we and other solid waste management entities that the state works closely with.
Okay, so you said people who – institutions who generate 2 tons of waste a week, food waste a week, start this year. Next year it goes down to include institutions and organizations that generate about 1 ton of food waste mm-hmm. per month, mm-hmm. and eventually gets down to all the rest of us. So
correct.
When do I have to comply?
You would be July 1, 2020.
Okay, so individuals have a few years to figure this all out.
Yeah.
And it, as I said, in the second part of this discussion, we're going to talk a little bit about how to do that for people who are thinking, what? I have to compost? How do I do that? But if you have questions about the implementation of the law, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your compost photos on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Grace, who's calling in from Barnet. Hi, Grace. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having this show. I am on the board of the Highfield Center for Composting, and I understand that Maya Hansen is on your program, one of our one of our treasured staff people.
That's right. Yeah, she'll be on in just a moment.
And I wanted to find out more about how the state is planning to finance implementation of Act 148. We at Highfields have been working on what we call the Close-the-Loop program, which I'm sure Maya will mention. But we really are struggling to be able to support that, which would really replicate throughout communities in Vermont ways to set up community-scale composting programs that will, in fact, be able to set this up.
Yeah, help. Grace, I got what you're saying. And since we have Josh Kelly here, let's put it to him. What about funding, state funding, to implement the Universal Recycling Law Act 148?
Yeah, so the state is very aware that of the need, and ANR is aware of the need for funding to implement the law. And to that end, we did recommend to the legislature, we put a report publicly available on our website to the legislature of the needs around this law. And one of those items was for funding to implement it. We basically asked for the franchise fee to increase from $6 a ton. This is the fee on trash that's produced in the state, from $6 a ton to $12 a ton. It hasn't changed in, I think, 20 years. So that money would be available for infrastructure improvements. It could be for everything from, you know, hauler containers for haulers or for other facilities, such as for recycling or for composting, and for infrastructure improvements, you know, site compost site development, and one thing I'll mention is there is a grant opportunity for digesters right now who are considering how to accept food scraps is sort of separate from food residuals, and that is through the Clean Energy Development Fund of the Public Service Department in partnership with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, and it's a $150,000 grant. They have a request for proposals out. So that's a piece of money that could be used to help some infrastructure develop. And I'm sure, Jane, you've reported on it, House Senate Bill 208 before. There was a dollar increase proposed to the state franchise fee. I'm not aware of where that bill stands currently, but it's sort of my other colleagues who manage that side of it.
Yeah, nor am I, but we can find out. And if we do, we'll put it on our website. We got a note from Peter and Barry who, you know, speaking of where all this is going to go, Peter says, you know, this is about large volumes of product, this law. So who or what mechanism is being put in place to scoop up any unsold product? Also, grades of compost product are varied. Not all will grow table grapes or heirloom tomatoes. So what progress is being made to establish at least three broad categories, like human food production, animal forage, and roadside parks soil amendment? Are you going to separate out compost so that we, when we're all composting, you know, we know what the compost is going for and what's going to happen to it?
There's a lot packed into that question. I would say, you know, the state supports diversity of approaches to really implement this law. So that's everything from, you know, homeowners, you know, taking their neighbors' food scraps and composting them in their backyard, which I encourage folks to do, to you know, folks using food scraps for animal feed. I've been contacted about that, and folks should be aware about some of the state law around pig feed specifically and food scraps. There's legal ways to do it, and it's certainly encouraged in the right circumstances. So I think there's going to be a diversity of approaches. There is different grades of compost, certainly, and so some of those will be prioritized for, you know, for farming and raised beds, and then others may be more of a quality that lend to road projects, things like that.
But is there, so if all of this compost is now going at some point to transfer stations, what do the transfer stations do with it? I mean, is there a mechanism for them to get rid of it so that we can, you know, that it all sort of keeps going in that wonderful feedback loop?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is a lot of existing infrastructure right now in the state of Vermont, which is really, really good for us, really valuable. You know, Massachusetts and Connecticut both are looking at organics bans, or have them, for large generators of waste. So Vermont's not alone, but we probably have more composting infrastructure than those two states. Certainly on the small scale, we have a lot of small scale composters with some existing capacity. And so there's at least 10 in the state that we permit, and those transfer stations that get more material can then send that to these composters. Now, they need to work with those composters, and there needs to be a communication link there. But there, that's already happening to some degree in some areas. Chittenden County, there's free drop-off of your food scraps and has been for many, many years, and that goes to Green Mountain Composting Facility. In Williston. So that's just one example of how that's working.
We're talking today about composting. It's a big part of Vermont's universal recycling law, and some of the requirements for mandatory composting or food waste diversion go into effect this summer. If you have questions about it, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're looking at composting today, something that many Vermonters are going to have to get familiar with as a new law goes into effect that will ban all food scraps and yard waste from landfills. The rules are going to be phased in, and this summer, businesses or institutions that produce more than 104 tons of food scraps per year must divert that material if a composting facility is within 20 miles of them. But in just a few years, individuals will have to compost as well. And to that end, we're going to take a look now at some of the best ways to make composting work for you. If you have questions, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or hey, post your picture of your compost pile. We know many of you are proud of them. You can post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking with Josh Kelly with the Agency of Natural Resources, and we're joined now by Maya Henson. She teaches composting workshops for the Highfield Center for Composting, a nonprofit in Hardwick that promotes education and research in composting. Maya Henson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jake, just give us the very briefest overview for somebody who, I mean, I can't believe anybody in Vermont would be in this position, but who's never composted, never heard of composting, doesn't get the concept.
Well, it's as simple as putting your food scraps in a pile. Nature has really perfected the way in which decomposition happens. And so there's really not that much involved. The way to start is probably to choose a bin system that works for the space and time you have and how much material you're producing. A lot of people will be adding not just food scraps, but maybe their garden material or lawn trimmings, things like that. Some things people don't usually know is that you have to add a lot of this kind of carbon-rich material. So dried leaves and hay and wood chips are really beneficial for making your food scraps break down.
Right, because you teach some extreme composting workshops, and I was looking at some of your slides, and you have to learn to be aware of your nitrogen content versus your carbon content and which kind of source material will provide you with which.
Yeah, so we're looking for ideal ratio of 30 to 1 of carbon to nitrogen, which usually means about 3 times as much carbon material as you would have nitrogen. And the nitrogen material, that's mostly just food scraps, maybe some fresh grass clippings. Some people maybe might have manures. Those are all considered nitrogen rich. And then the carbon rich materials are hay, wood chips, dried leaves, all that dried sort of material.
All right. And the idea here in the end is you get some beautiful compost that you can add to your soil and it might help grow your veggies or supply your fruits and vegetables.
That's the idea. So you get this really nutrient-rich soil amendment. It's kind of unbelievable the benefits that compost have. Of course, you're going to be adding nutrients to your soil and the microbes within the compost are really making those nutrients available to plants.
All right, we've got questions, as you might imagine, from listeners, and Josh and Maya, I'll give these to both of you. Scott wrote in with several questions, but namely he says, there are many groups of people who aren't currently capable of composting, people who live in an apartment and have no land or space for a compost pile, elderly or disabled people who aren't physically able to manage a compost pile or a bin, people who don't have the knowledge of how to compost or who can't afford to buy a compost bin. So how does the law address the mandatory nature of composting for these people? And similarly, Kathy in East Montpelier says, how is this going to work for renters and who will monitor the compost of apartment dwellers so that things like meat scraps and cat poop won't be in there with the vegetable scraps? So a couple different issues here, but one is space constraints or issues for people who don't feel that they're able to do, that sort of big bin system or turning a bin or, shoveling it from one bin to the next. So first of all, how's the law going to address that, Josh?
Well, to get at the convenience part of the law and its intent is that transfer stations and haulers, anybody who is collecting solid waste needs to be offering the services for collection of organics. Now, we talked about recyclables being due for transfer stations this summer. Organics, food scraps are also on the list. So your transfer station will be offering collection services of food scraps. Let me just double check on my dates. I think it's July 1, 2017. And haulers also will be offering food scrap collection by that time. Now, there can be a charge for that service, but that means that the service is now available to residents.
So if you have curbside pickup of your trash, you will eventually have curbside pickup of your compost.
It will be offered to you. That service needs to be offered to you. Yes.
Okay. And what about monitoring, Kathy says, to make sure that there's not cat poop in our compost? Or maybe there will be, and maybe that's okay.
State inspectors that are going out to everybody's compost pile. I can say that. But you get these questions a lot about meat in compost and then the cat, pet waste issue.
That's not the first time you've heard that.
No, it comes up all the time. So first and foremost, pet waste is not being regulated through this law. You can still dispose of it, in your trash or however you're managing it. But for some Vermonters that want to manage that, on site, I certainly would never advocate for use of pet waste compost in any garden or anything. But I do want to get across that composting is not just an activity of gardeners. It gets all tangled up in that only gardeners compost, and I don't think that's true. For this law to be effective, many Vermonters need to find a way to compost, and it may be sort of a set it and forget it kind of method, and that's okay. So there are container systems. One of them is the Green Cone, and then there's another one that's sold at Gardener's Supply where you can literally put your food scraps into these bins. They are buried partly in the ground, and they will slowly decompose your food scraps. And you can use them for pet waste. Some of these products are for pet waste too. But pet waste is not regulated by the law, and people should know that as far as the meat and bones issue of composting, those are not required to be separated if you are home composting. The law actually excludes those at the home scale. If you bring them to a transfer station, yeah, you should bring those with you. And all the composters that are certified in the state of Vermont to accept food scraps are taking meat, bones, dairy products. And the reason they can is because they have hot compost piles. They have mass, they have scale, 12 feet wide, 4 foot tall piles. These are big piles. And they heat up right through January, 140, 160 degrees is a very common temperature.
Okay, so there is, you can throw your meat if you're going to the big composters.
Correct.
Maya, if you are a renter or if you're somebody who's living in a small apartment, there are still ways that you can compost. You may not have a garden to put it on, but what can people do?
One simple way is to have an indoor worm bin, and you can't put all of your food scraps into it, but it's definitely a good way to keep a low-maintenance pet and have some, get your carrot peels and your apple cores, simple to break down items to feed to worms. And they make this really nutrient-rich product, vermicompost or worm castings that, it's a multivitamin for your plants.
Right, so you could use it on your house plants even,
yeah.
Right? And then if you don't want to have to deal with that yourself, you can put your food scraps in a freezer. That's what I've heard is a good way for people who want to then take it out to maybe their transfer station but who don't want to have to deal with smelly compost in their kitchen.
Definitely, yeah. So there are more and more food scrap drop-offs popping up, and as Josh was saying, it's going to be everywhere eventually. So freezing your food scraps makes you not so unpopular when you're on public transportation or something like that, and really having to bring your food scraps from one place to the other.
You mentioned worm composting, and we got a note from Sarah who says, I just visited a friend in New York State who has a worm composter in her kitchen. No smell whatsoever, and I do have a sensitive nose. So can you explain a little bit more how worm composting works?
Yeah, it's really simple. The only way it could get smelly is if you're adding too much food material. So they want a lot of shredded newspaper. You want to moisten it first and lay down a bed for them and then add some worms. We use red wigglers at our compost site, and all worms kind of do their thing. But it's really just layers of moistened newspaper, a little bit of food scraps, and maybe a little soil to keep the worms happy.
Do you have to turn it at all?
You don't have to turn it. Sometimes if it gets matted down, you want to kind of fluff it up a little bit with your hands. And then to harvest the material, you're just scooping it from either the bottom or the sides.
We got a note from Carl Hammer, who's president of the Vermont Compost Company, and he says, you know, Vermont's solid waste rule requires that compostable materials, how do you say that, compostable or compostable? You say compostable? Okay. Anyway, Carl says, Vermont's rule requires that compostable materials be source separated to avoid contaminating soil with uncompostable trash. The most visible challenge is the large volume and assortment of plastics involved in food packaging. These include everything from plastic bags, wrapping films, and perhaps the most difficult to remove of all, the little plastic PLU stickers affixed to almost every piece of fruit we can buy. Carl says it's cheaper and easier for generators and haulers to look the other way about plastic contamination, which may result in a race to the bottom in quality. What plans does the Agency of Natural Resources have to protect composters, their customers, and the soil from this threat? Josh?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it is of concern. Basically, when you start to divert more and more organics, there's a higher likelihood of trash making its way into those food scraps material. And the composters around the state are not unfamiliar with this challenge. Anybody who's dealt with food waste has faced this in their trials and tribulations with it. So we're aware of it. We have established a working group with the Composting Association of Vermont. Highfields is present. The Agency of Agriculture is there with us. And in that working group, we talk about these issues, trying to basically address issues of concern to the composting community. They supply a lot of the infrastructure right now for organics management and processing, and I think will continue to play a strong role in the implementation of the universal recycling law. So it's not a small issue, but it's one that we have to work on with haulers, with generators of waste, with solid waste management entities, the districts, the solid waste local governments that do a lot of education and outreach on this. And they've been doing that for – a lot of them have been doing that for many years. The Central Vermont Solid Waste District, Chittenden Solid Waste District do a lot of education and outreach to generators of food waste about what can go in and what can't. That training is a critical part of the implementation of the law. And so when you see the agency is working on a new materials management plan, there's a draft on our website. This is the plan that other solid waste management entities need to come in compliance with and create their own plans. The bottom line is there's more requirements in there for these local governments to do outreach and education. And that's geared towards trying to minimize the trash contamination of food waste, in addition to a whole host of other things, just raising awareness in general about the law and what's required.
We're getting some people telling us about their composting. Robin says, my pig is my composter. Veggies only, please. Becca posted a photo of her compost bin to Facebook and says, year 3 of home composting. It was so exciting getting used to our compost in the garden last year. We put everything but large quantities of meat in it. It's allowed us to reduce our two-person garbage to one 30-gallon bag every 4 weeks, and we use hay as our brown material when no leaves or grass clippings are available. We also got a note from Sherry in Brattleboro who says she has curbside pickup of compost as well as recyclables and trash. Containers for compost were sold at a nominal price, and she says since May of 2013, I've been composting used litter from our 5 inside cats along with other compostable materials that can't be put in my home compost. She says she has also been able to reduce her trash considerably to very little every week. And let's go to Martina calling in from Norwich. Hi, Martina. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you for the program. It's very good. I have a composter, but that only takes a vegetable matter. And it says distinctly on there you cannot put meats or bones in there or anything with grease.
So no meat, no bones, and you want to know what? How can you compost?
Yes.
Yeah. How can Martina compost that kind of material, Maya?
So the reason that people stay away from meat is that it might take a while to break down, and in that time, we'll really be attracting wild animals or even your own pets. But really capping it with this dry, brown, carbon-rich material will help to deter those animals and kind of having a system where it's heating. So even at a home compost scale, you can have your compost heat. You just need to add plenty of browns, add plenty of air by turning your pile, and really be creating this correct recipe.
Okay, so we're hearing here about composting. Let's go to Fred, who's calling in from Barrie. Hi, Fred. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks. This is a great program. I'm the chairperson for the Central Vermont Solid Waste District, and we've been doing composting for a good 10 years now. And Highfield and Carl Hammer and Grow Compost are three of our partners. One of the problems is that the product that they make doesn't have a market to go out. It's harder for them to market. It actually costs us money to tip the compost at their facilities or the raw materials. One of the things we would like the state to do is come up with a use program for landscapers and municipalities to put a percentage of this compost into their plans whenever they do maintenance, like whether it be road work, gardening, or anything like that. And I think that would be a real shot in the arm to our composters, and it would also help lower the tipping price and help the whole program take off.
Yeah, Fred, thanks for the call. Josh Kelly, what about that?
Yeah, it's a great point. Basically, the more money, the more you can improve the market for compost, the more folks you can entice into the industry, the more infrastructure you can develop then, and the more of a value you can put on the material. And the state has had some of those conversations with other departments already and will continue as part of their of our work to implement this law. We do see the need to work with agencies such as Forest, Parks, and Rec with trying to use some of the compost there if possible, and VTrans with road projects. We sort of touched on that at the beginning of the show. So there's a need for increasing the use and the specs. I know there's a new storm water management guide the state's working on that talks about use of compost in there. We need to raise the markets for compost, and we're definitely aware of that and going to be working on that.
Josh, when we look at how this is going to be implemented throughout the state, and as we said, it's a phased-in approach, is it likely that people are going to start seeing increased fees, though, for either their trash, depending on what haulers and transfer stations are doing to sort of shift costs, or even on composting itself? Are we going to see this sort of rise in price or a lowering in price because everybody's doing it?
Let me take that in parts. I will say that in terms of trash costs, I think for the homeowner, for the resident who's listening to the show, you really need to think about what's going to be most affordable to you. And I think composting at home is most affordable. You buy a bin, and please consider buying some hardware cloth. It's always it's galvanized wire mesh, a good way to manage your food scraps to prevent critters. You buy a bin, and you can manage those food scraps at home for many folks, but not for everybody. So the next probably most affordable option will be at the transfer station. And there's some savings, too, to this picture. When you start separating food scraps, your trash reduction will occur, as you had one commenter already say. So you're saving some money. So if there's a fee at the transfer station, that might be a wash there. Certainly, curbside collection will be more costly than those other options. But there will be more options which will provide convenience. And then for the larger generators, by having more material available, it increases the haulers that are hauling. And right now we have actually several, quite a multitude of haulers that haul food scraps and or other organics in the state, and that will increase. And I think that will create more competition, but also just more people providing the service, which I think will bring costs down.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. That's Josh Kelly. He's an environmental analyst with the Waste Management and Prevention Division at the Agency of Natural Resources. Thanks very much, Josh.
Thank you.
And Maya Hansen teaches composting workshops for the Highfield Center for Composting, a nonprofit in Hardwick. Thank you very much, Maya.
Thank you.
We should say as well, Highfields has composting seminars online and around the state all week for International Compost Awareness Week. Maya is going to be teaching some of them herself, and you can find a schedule at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Each school year, Vermont 4th through 8th graders read books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award and then vote for a winner. Now the books have all been read, the votes tallied, and we have a winner.
And this year's DCF winner is Wonder by R.J. Palacio. Wonder is the story of a boy just trying to fit in who has an unusual facial deformity, and it's told from the perspective of many kids in his fifth grade class, and it's a fantastic book. It was also chosen as the Vermont Reads book this year. So if you haven't had a chance to read it yet, definitely get out there and give it a try.
That was Meadowee Community School librarian Kelly Offeld announcing the winner to students from the Manchester area. They were gathered at the Greater Northshire Access TV studio in Sunderland. In this school year's final installment of our series, Dorothy's List, VPR's Amy Noyes takes a look at the novel Wonder and introduces us to some of the nominees for next year's book award.
When Dorothy's List spoke to R.J. Palacio earlier this year, she said she didn't set out to write an anti-bullying book, but rather a story about kindness. But, she said, she is pleased with the way wonder is being used in schools to address issues like bullying and acceptance.
The way that people have rallied around it, the way teachers and librarians have embraced it as a great starting point for discussing bullying in classrooms and in schools, and the fact that, unfortunately, it proved to be quite timely in terms of today and the events of today. It's been really wonderful for the book, and it's been wonderful for me knowing that maybe it's had an impact.
But the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award winner isn't chosen by teachers and librarians. It's a Reader's Choice Award, and the readers are in the 4th through 8th grades. Wonder obviously appeals to kids as well as teachers and librarians. Grace Green is the Youth Services Consultant for the Vermont Department of Libraries. She says wonder resonates with kids for the same reasons adults have embraced it.
Every one of us has felt like an outsider at some point in our lives, and we all have sympathy for the outsiders. But we also are very aware that we haven't always been as nice as we could have to the person that is different. And this makes us think about that once again. And yet with humor, it's not a didactic book at all. Some of it is laugh out loud funny, but it's also poignant and it's also sad. But I think every kid that I've heard say anything about it said, well, it really made me think about how I act, what I do when I meet somebody new, what I say when somebody looks different. I think it's a very powerful book.
Even before Wonder was named this year's winner, some Vermont middle schoolers had already begun reading their way through the next list of 30 nominees. Linda Urban is one of the Vermont authors on the new list. Her novel, The Center of Everything, is the second book she's written to be nominated for the award. Urban says the idea for The Center of Everything came to her while watching Montpelier's 4th of July parade.
And so I was standing there on the parade route, imagining what it would be like for a kid who is fully invested in this parade. And I imagined the back of a girl's head and her curls wet with sweat. And then I wondered what was so exciting for her. What was she waiting for? And that question came to me over and over again. What is it? What matters? What's about to happen to this girl? And that was the start of The Center of Everything.
Before she was a published children's book author, Urban served on the volunteer committee that decides what books should be on the Dorothy Canfield Fisher list. So she knows just how tough the competition is.
I'm so happy that the committee members for the DCF decided that this book was a book they wanted kids to read, and that so many Vermont kids will find this book in their libraries and at their local bookstores and have conversations about it. It's a huge thing for an author, and I'm just delighted.
Tanya Lee Stone is another Vermont author on the new list. In fact, she has books nominated for both the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award and Vermont's Red Clover Picture Book Award.
It's true. Who Says Women Can't Be Doctors is on the Red Clover list, and Courage Has No Color is on the DCF list. And I've never been on the DCF list before, so that was extremely thrilling. Just the thought that the kids that I see every day are going to be reading this book is really fun and just great. I mean, I love this community in Vermont, the writers and the librarians. And I do school visits around the state, so it's really pretty cool.
Stone's book, Courage Has No Color, is a nonfiction narrative about the 555th Parachute Infantry. The 555th, also called the Triple Nickels, were this country's first black paratroopers who trained during World War II. Before Courage Has No Color was published, no one had ever written a book about the triple nickels, so finding out the facts and tracking down pictures was a big part of the job.
In a story like this that's little known, you have to really be a detective and track people down. So I was on Zaba search looking for relatives of men who had passed away, looking at obituary notices to find names of next of kin, sending cold emails and leaving cold phone messages in the hopes that I had found the right family member and that they would be willing to call me back. Some of those leads didn't pan out. A lot of them did. When you're telling an unknown story, the people on the other end are very happy that you're trying to tell the story of someone who they love. And that was great.
Tanya Lee Stone's Courage Has No Color and Linda Urban's The Center of Everything are just two of the 30 books that students will read to choose next year's award recipient. Here's the Vermont Department of Libraries' Grace Green to walk us through some of her favorites, starting with Kate DiCamillo's Newbery Medal winner, Flora and Ulysses.
Okay, Flora and Ulysses is one of the best books of all time, in my humble opinion. It is so funny. The language she uses is so fabulous. And who wouldn't love a squirrel that had been sucked up by a vacuum and when he came out was suddenly able to talk and fly and do all these other wonderful things?
The novel Zebra Forest is another of Grace Green's top picks.
It's about a girl who has three wishes at the beginning of every summer: to grow tall, to have an adventure, and to meet her father. Now, since everybody in her family is pretty small, and she lives in a little tiny town, and her father is dead, it's really unlikely that any of these are going to come true. But when there is a breakout at the local prison, and there is a man who comes and stays at their house and takes them hostage, she finds out that everything she thought about her family is not true.
The Adventures of a South Pole Pig is another of Green's favorites.
I love this book. I would have absolutely adored this when I was a kid. Flora is a pig that wants to go on adventure. She does not want to stay in the pig pen and just root around. No, she wants to go out and meet people and do things. And so when she sees the farmer training his dogs to be sled dogs, she thinks, this is what I want to do. And she trains, and she trains, and she trains. And then there is an expedition to Antarctica, and all the dogs are taken, and so is Flora. But you, the reader, will know that the reason she thinks she is going is not the reason that they are taking her.
Her next pick is P.S. B-11. It's a sequel to Rita Williams Garcia's One Crazy Summer. But Grace Green says it can stand on its own.
This is about three sisters in the 1960s, three African-American sisters who have spent the summer with their mother in Oakland and with the Black Panthers and are now back in New York with their grandmother, who has very different ideas about how young Black girls should behave. Delphine, the oldest of the sisters, writes to her mother and tells her about all the things she's doing and trying to make her sisters behave and what she's reading. And the mother writes back and always ends up with P.S. B-11. In other words, don't grow up too fast. Read it. You'll love it.
Here are a couple more titles Grace Green recommends, starting with a nonfiction book called Primates.
Okay, this is a graphic biography of the three women that Louis Leakey started off on their careers, Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, and Birute Galdikas, telling about their studies with chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans. And these are three of my heroes. I found this totally fascinating the way he presented it. Better Nate Than Ever is actually one of my favorite books on the list. It's about a 14-year-old boy that grew up in small-town Pennsylvania and whose ambition all his life has been to be on Broadway. So he and his friend come up with this plan for him to go secretly to New York City to audition for E.T. the musical. And so it's quite an interesting story about what he finds in New York when he gets there. Prisoner 88 is not nonfiction, but it's based on an actual incident. It took place in 1885 in the Idaho Territory. A 10-year-old boy was condemned to go to prison for killing a man. He was happier in prison because for the first time he got full meals and a regular place to live, they also made him learn how to read and write, and he thought that was the worst thing that ever happened to him.
Those are just a few of the nominees for the next Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. You can find the full list at vpr.net. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
And that wraps up our series for this school year. Dorothy's List will return in the fall when we'll take a monthly look at the books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. This series is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. Now, as we said, the novel Wonder is the winner of this year's award. It's also the Vermont Humanity Council's choice for the community literature program Vermont Reads. VPR will be presenting a series of interviews and stories about Wonder later this month. Listen for that during Morning Edition. That's it for today. Tomorrow, it's our Spring Bird Show. Bridget Butler will join us to talk about how this year's ice and cold affected the birds that overwinter here and about how the late spring is affecting those who are migrating back to the state now. Send your comments or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.